This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. When news stories break of mothers being arrested for neglect of their children, it's often presumed that they're guilty. After all, we are awash in parenting advice and ideas about what is best for children, advice that is more often geared towards mothers than fathers, and rarely geared towards society or government. Today, American mothers are criminalized more than ever, from conception and pregnancy to birth and beyond. Well, how did it get this way, and where is this dangerous trend heading? My guest is Linda Fentiman. She is a professor at the Elizabeth Hobbs Law School at Pace University and a fellow of the New York Academy of Medicine. She joins me to discuss her new book, Blaming Mothers, American Law and the Risks to Children's Health. Welcome to the program, Linda.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
So first, let's talk about the ways in which women are disproportionately blamed for what happens to their children compared to men. So mothers much more blamed than fathers. You point out in your book that even for things like child abuse and manslaughter and murder, mothers have been criminally prosecuted for failing to protect their children, but fathers are rarely prosecuted when they fail to protect their children from similar abuse. How is that? I mean, we imagine that the law is this sort of, you know, a neutral thing, but how is it even in cases of sexual abuse or physical abuse that the mothers are blamed for failing to protect their children more so than fathers?
Well, I think what happens is in the law, as it is in the rest of life, everybody's affected by unconscious biases, unconscious expectations. And in American society, and probably every society, there's a belief that a mother should be all perfect, all doing everything possible to protect her child. And frankly, we don't expect that of fathers. And so there are neutral principles of the law, principles of how a reasonable person should behave that govern both tort law, civil suits, and criminal suits. And yet, unconsciously, we apply slightly different standards to mothers as opposed to fathers. In cases where the parent who has not abused the child, but her partner or his partner has abused the child, very often the laws, the child abuse statutes, which govern the criminal prosecution of child abuse, permit a prosecutor to frame the action or inaction of the parent in a different way for mothers or fathers. So if, for example, a mother is aware perhaps that her boyfriend is abusing her child, but she can't leave right away, either because she's economically dependent on him or he does the child care, even if she's plotting and planning to get away from him, the way she cannot always immediately prevent the abuse. And in about 40 to 45% of these cases, the mother herself is the victim of intimate partner violence from the man who really uses the child abuse as a way to get back at the mother and to control her. So in these cases, the prosecutors say every parent has a duty to act to protect her child, and the mother failed to act by not immediately getting out of this abusive situation. And therefore, because she was aware of the possibility that her child might be abused, she is guilty either of manslaughter, if she was actually aware of the risk, or simply negligent homicide, if she should have been aware of the risk of harm,
right,
but was not.
Now, these disproportionate applications of law go all the way back to pregnancy. We've heard the case of Purvi Patel in Indiana, who was criminalized and incarcerated for essentially having what amounted to a miscarriage. And we've also seen in recent days Republican lawmakers saying things like men shouldn't be responsible for paying for prenatal care, even though, of course, men have to be absolutely involved in the conceiving of children. How does the pressure to give women and the pressure that mothers face from society in terms of the advice to be the best possible incubator for a child, how does that translate into then blaming women when things turn out bad? Because as I mentioned, we live in this culture today where you have an industry of parenting advice, and women feel like, you know, if they sleep the wrong way, they might scar their unborn child for life. You know, if they're not taking their prenatal vitamins, there's so many factors, such as drug use, cigarette smoking, prescription medication, antidepressants, etc., that women are warned will harm their fetus. And that then turns into blaming them and criminalizing them if they fail on any of these accounts. Is this a relatively new trend?
Yes, I think it is a relatively new trend. And so, for example, in the 1950s in the United States, the belief of most obstetricians was the best way to have a healthy baby was to have a healthy mother. And so the two, the mother and the child, were treated as a unit that should be treated carefully and nurturingly together. But really, beginning around the time of Roe v. Wade, when abortion became legal in the United States, at the same time, medical technology was advancing that permitted physicians and others to see the fetus as an entity separate from the mother in whose body the child was developing. And so what happened is, partly as the agenda of anti-abortion activists, and partly as a result of changes in medicine itself, there became a push to have a perfect pregnancy and for physicians and other healthcare professionals to intervene very aggressively. The fact is that childbirth is healthier today than it's been in decades, and yet there's more and more subtle and not so subtle pressure put on pregnant women to do everything possible to have a healthy birth. And many women, of course, put this pressure on themselves as well. At the same time, there are miscarriages, there are stillbirths, there are other adverse birth outcomes. And in many cases, it's impossible to know what caused the adverse birth outcome?
Right. And I think it's really important that you pointed out that often mothers blame themselves. I mean, sadly, because of the pressures from society, mothers blame themselves for, you know, having C-sections, for being unable to breastfeed, for, you know, having, so, you know, for being unable to feed their children the healthiest food once they're born. There's so many ways in which mothers blame themselves. That's one issue. And they feel often indicted by society if they happen to have the less than perfect birth or pregnancy.
Right.
But then to have that translated by the courts as this is now your fault, if there's been harm done to the fetus or the baby, you are going to be prosecuted, it just seems to be a remarkable leap because, of course, the thing that children need most of all when they are born are present parents, such as mothers. But how can mothers be present when they are facing criminalization, sometimes prison time?
Yes, so in the 1980s and the 1990s, some women were prosecuted for child abuse or for, quote, delivering drugs to a minor during the period right after birth, when if the mother had used drugs prior to birth, those would be transmitted over through the umbilical cord. But almost all of those prosecutions were thrown out by the courts, who said basically a fetus is not a child, there was an old English rule that was the law in the United States that unless a person was born, there could be no criminal prosecution, there could be no civil lawsuit. It was only born children that could be subject to the law's protection. Then, starting in the late 1990s, more and more women began to be criminally prosecuted for using alcohol and other drugs while pregnant. And in many cases, it seems that the prosecutors, first the healthcare professionals, and then prosecutors, have not endeavored at all to understand the situation in which the pregnant woman finds herself. Instead, they take a highly punitive approach. Often the causation element is not clear because, for example, when children are stillborn, it's not known why, but prosecutors have seized upon the birth of a child who is stillborn and the mother used cocaine or another drug, and they have prosecuted those women for murder. So it's really quite frightening, the situation that we're in. And this is definitely escalated with the rise in strength of the anti-abortion movement, because any time that a prosecutor can establish that a fetus is a person, that's a win for those who are opposed to abortion.
Right. So these fetal personhood laws that have popped up in so many states around the country have fed the ongoing criminalization of mothers and women who might be pregnant. Let's talk about the intersection between poverty and motherhood and how poor women are far more likely to face penalties, face prosecution and incarceration than women who have means, than higher income women. Often, of course, it's poorer women who might be more likely to be single mothers, have fewer support systems, have less access to healthcare, etc. Why is it that we blame the poor women instead of blaming the society that allows such poverty to happen? To take place? I mean, in other countries, as soon as a mother is pregnant, often you will have a lot more support for that pregnancy from the state offered to mothers, but it's not as much so in the U.S., right?
Yes. So in the U.S., although the Affordable Care Act has made some strides in this direction, there isn't guaranteed prenatal care. Many poor women don't see a doctor until later in their pregnancy, so they are already at risk. Also, poor women are more likely to begin a pregnancy first accidentally, because the United States has a very high rate of teenage pregnancy. Second, poor women have less adequate nutrition. They may often themselves have been victims of child abuse or sexual abuse as a child, and they are much more vulnerable to an abusive partner as a young pregnant woman. Sometimes they take refuge in alcohol and other drugs. Sometimes they're trying desperately to do the right thing for their child, but they just don't have the resources to do that. And Sonali, what was your second question, or the second part of this question?
That how do poor mothers, and how is it that poor mothers don't get the kind, how is it that that translates into criminality instead of blaming society, right? I mean, we should be, when we say, as your book points out, if it takes a village to raise a child, it only takes a mother to harm her. Why aren't we prosecuting the village for failing mothers?
Well, I think because there's a natural human tendency to find one source of harm in any case. And
is American law geared towards that, by the way, individual responsibility and harm rather than societal?
Yes, absolutely. In America, I tell my law students that every American's middle name is autonomy, because we really value individual action so much. Unlike European countries, unlike many other Western democracies, we don't believe in collective action. We don't have the legislation for example, maternity leave, paternity leave. We don't guarantee health care to all our citizens. And so it is very much that an individual woman, whether she's poor or not, is really on her own. And then when something bad happens, it's the natural human tendency to blame the victim, the mother. At the same time, there are unconscious psychological processes that affect all of us, that all of us use them. So for example, something known as the hindsight bias. If something bad happens, we tend to believe that it must have always been obvious that it would have happened, even though that's not the case. There's something called the fundamental attribution error, which basically says everybody wants to believe that the world is a just place and that good things happen to good people, and if something bad happens, it means that that person is bad and somehow.
And that's the American view of poverty and in income inequality in general, right? That basically poor people are poor because they've chosen to be poor. They somehow deserve poverty, and that wealthy people are so because they worked hard and they deserve it. That's kind of an overarching, prevailing view in the United States.
I think it's longstanding, sort of the Protestant ethic, the work ethic, and the again, the inability to look at other forces that make life a struggle for many poor people. The fact that we don't have adequate minimum wages. So it is really very difficult to raise a family, even to be a pregnant woman, without the ability to earn a higher salary. And many pregnant women, of course, are hourly workers. They're not salaried women who earn a decent living. And if in American law, the reasonable person is the standard for negligence, in fact, the reasonable person translates to the reasonable mother. And the reasonable mother is through our own unconscious biases that we believe that mothers should really do everything, always be self-sacrificing on behalf of their children, that we hold mothers to a higher standard. When you couple that with a hindsight bias, if something bad happens to a fetus, if there's a bad birth outcome, or to a child, then the mother is blamed. And a classic example took place in Utah about a dozen years ago. A poor woman became pregnant and decided to give up her children for adoption. She went to Utah because that was a relatively inexpensive place to live, and she was having trouble in her pregnancy. She went to the emergency room and she was urged to have a cesarean section, but she didn't. She chose not to. After she gave birth, one of the two twins that she was carrying was stillborn. And the prosecutor charged her with first degree murder.
Wow.
She faced the death penalty. The prosecutor said, this is maternal selfishness.
Wow.
She refused to have a C-section because she didn't want a scar, which the woman denied. But it doesn't matter. Everybody has the right to give informed consent to their own medical care. For whatever reason, she chose not to have a C-section. The doctors didn't challenge her, and yet she was charged with what's called in the law depraved heart recklessness, extreme selfishness, recognizing that her child might die if she didn't have a C-section. Ultimately, the prosecutor dropped those charges and she was allowed to plead guilty to a very minor charge.
And,
but the point, go ahead.
One of the things that's so sad about stories like this is that, of course, when a child is stillborn, when there is harm during pregnancy or after pregnancy, it is such a traumatizing time for a mother, for a woman. It's the, you know, probably the worst possible moment in that person's life. And then to have that double traumatizing, to see yourself being criminalized, that's just really, really, that's really sad.
That is extremely sad. And what this example shows is often there's interaction between healthcare professionals, physicians and nurses and physician assistants, for example, and law enforcement. So why would it be that the prosecutor got involved in this unless somebody at that hospital in Utah decided that the mother had behaved badly,
right,
for failing to have a C-section? And there's a case, for example, more recently in Iowa, where Christine Taylor was a young mother. She fell down the stairs. She went to the hospital, went to the emergency room to get checked out. And at some point, when the people in the emergency room were asking her how she felt, she said, "Well, to tell you the truth, I feel a little ambivalent. My husband has just abandoned me. I have two other young children. I don't know how I feel about being pregnant right now." And as a result of her candor with the hospital personnel, she was arrested by local police for attempted feticide.
Wow.
The theory that she had intended to kill this fetus by falling down the stairs. And although the prosecutor ultimately dropped the charges because her pregnancy was not far enough along, it's an absurd result. And the message it sends to pregnant women is don't ever be candid with a healthcare provider, because they may turn you into the police.
And we should also remind ourselves that often women suffer from depression related to pregnancy. So the things that they might say in that state doesn't necessarily reflect anything other than feeling a sort of depression, which, you know, of course, may not be taken into account.
Yes, and of course, pregnancy releases many, many hormones, and women while they're pregnant do have many emotional ups and downs. And yet that can't be the basis for a criminal prosecution.
Right. I mean, at the time when women need the most support, they are often sort of blamed for these sorts of things. Now, finally, Linda, let's talk about how after birth, women are also held responsible for what happens to their children. In a country where there is very little support for child care, and, you know, poor women, of course, disproportionately are impacted by this. I remember the case of the woman who was arrested for letting her daughter, like a 9-year-old daughter, play at a nearby park while she worked her shift at a fast food restaurant because she couldn't afford the summer school program or whatever child care program that her child should have been in. And she was arrested when someone reported that there was an unaccompanied child at a park. I mean, again, we have the situation, and we don't hear the anti-abortionists ever really, emphasize that once children are born, there should be government support for their care.
Yes. So again, because of America's cultural and legal focus on individual responsibility, then we don't have widespread social support. We don't have affordable child care, and particularly single women who are much more likely to be poor, single mothers, they inevitably have to string together child care arrangements that may not be totally adequate. Often we see a bias by the local police, by the social workers, against poor people, against people of color, so that through this unconsciously biased lens, the mother who is not totally attentive to her child, a mother who makes a slightly different choice. We're not talking about mothers leaving very young children at home, but particularly single moms who are much less likely to be able to afford childcare, whose children are much more likely to be subject to child abuse by the mother's partner. Those women are judged through the unconscious bias of a social worker, of a prosecutor, who believes that mothers must never take their eyes off their children. And of course, in the 1950s, that wasn't the way at all in the United States. Mothers frequently let their children play all day at friends' houses without having constant calling in, and nobody thought anything about that. So we have heightened the standards of motherhood. We have really expected mothers to be always watching over their children. And from a psychological point of view, this may not be healthy, but certainly from the point of view of criminal prosecution, prosecutors and judges and juries are holding mothers to an impossibly high standard.
Right. And there's also a sort of whole school of thought about the harm that results to children when they're overparented, when there's constant contact and constant supervision. There's the free-range children's movement to counter that, but that's probably the subject for a whole nother interview. Linda, so much to talk about. I hope our audience picks up a copy of your book, Blaming Mothers, and reads it in its entirety themselves. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Simone.
My guest is Linda Fenteman. She's a professor at the Elizabeth Hobbs Law School at Pace University and a fellow of the New York Academy of Medicine. We've been talking about her book, Blaming Mothers: American Law and the Risks to Children's Health. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. And you can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.